Tax Committee will come to order. Members, today we're going to have an overview of the governor's budget, and we're going to have Dr. Stinson here to walk through the November forecast for us and give us some idea what kind of revenue is available. Take a look how the governor decided to spend it. So I think we'll start with Commissioner Ines.
Thank you, Chairman, for having us in front of your committee today to walk through the governor's tax bill. Senator Ortman is the chief author of the bill. I believe you are a co-author. I expect the bill to be introduced
tomorrow.
The first thing I want to do is clear up some confusion. There's a number of tax items in the governor's budget that are not being carried in the governor's tax bill. They're either items that you guys would have purview over if you wanted to review them, but they were deemed maybe more applicable to another budget division. For example, the governor is recommending $40 million to backfill some of the federal aid cuts to counties. Now, that was partially to take some of the pressure off having to go to the property tax for that, but that is being carried in the DHS budget. Your committee may want to have some review of that at some point. Another item is the governor is recommending dedicating the sales tax on leased vehicles in the same manner the constitutional amendment provided for, 60-40 split, but that's being carried in the MnDOT bill. Also, our compliance initiatives, which we've talked about, will not be carried in the governor's bill. They'll be carried in our agency bill. And so some of those tax items that we've talked about are not in the governor's bills before you today.
But Commissioner, can you send the committee in writing what those provisions are so that
there's about six or seven.
We can then hand it out to the members. We've got members that aren't here today, so it would be helpful if we could put it in their packet.
You bet. They're certainly within the purview of this committee, so we'll make sure you get that list. I guess I'll just start from Article 1, and we'll walk through the bill. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask it to stop me. Article 1 of the bill deals with the budget reserve. The governor's recommending putting an additional $47 million into the budget reserve to bring that up to $700 million. He's also setting out a schedule, or at least a target goal, of providing 5% of the budget reserve, 5% of the total of general fund revenue. So that would, based on a $30 billion plus biennium budget, that would be about $1.5 billion. So he's really committed to at least getting the budget reserve up to about 5%, which is what everybody deems is fiscally prudent. And he lays out a schedule in Section 2 of Article 1. Section 3 actually is part of the governor's property tax proposal. This is also will be talked about, I'm sure, in the K-12 funding division. But essentially what this does is increases the equalization rate for the capital operating K-12 levy. And this levy, and Tom Melcher is here to speak if there's any detailed questions asked, but this levy is about $110 million levy statewide. By increasing the equalization factor here, it provide a very balanced reduction across the state. We believe, based on our runs, what we got here, 328 of the 340 districts will be positively impacted by the state assuming a greater portion of this levy. Section 4 is the market value credit increase. The governor is recommending a $47 million increase in the market value credit. And as you know, that accrues directly to the homeowner. Essentially, the best way to look at this is that the maximum market value credit at $76,000 will stay the same, $304, but the phase out will be elongated. So most homeowners will receive about $40 more per homeowner. We actually have a chart that shows the phase out under current law and then under the governor's proposal.
So, Commissioner, does it phase out at the same number at the upper end?
No, the upper end phases out a little longer number, Chairman. It's $455,000 under the proposal. Under current law, it's $414,000. So it does extend the phase out also. But the maximum refund remains the same at $304. And that would positively impact about 1.3 million homesteads.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Mr.
That's correct. That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue. I just wanted to talk about the handout. Page 3 of that handout is a 3-page handout. It's kind of a graph showing the new market value credit. It kind of plateaus from 76 over to 118 and then down. Instead of down to the 414, present law would go to 455. So it's just kind of a graphic so you can kind of see how that's working.
Sections 5 through 11 pertain to levy limits. And for the most part, these levy limits are ones you're familiar with. They're very much modeled after what was done in 2004. They do not apply to cities under 2,500. They allow for levy growth for CPI and household growth. And you're still allowed to exceed the levy limit if you take the issue to the voters and get a referendum approval. The one twist is, as far as this one is that the levy limits also do not apply to any city that receives less than a third of their general operating budget from the state. So under our best guess, if this had been in place for taxes payable in 2007, I think about 87 cities would have been subject to the levy limits.
And members, the names of those cities are in your packet. There's a list in your packet who those 87 cities that would be impacted by this levy limit are.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I don't believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Commissioner, but the levy limits do not apply to any counties.
They do not. They do not. And that was the governor's recognition that the counties are uniquely situated as far as their mandate burden, the number of social services they deliver. None of the 87 counties would be impacted by these levy limits. Section 17 is the property tax refund. And the governor is, I guess I would say, juicing up the property tax refund to deal with those individuals who are at the maximum refund under current law and have what I call high property tax burdens relative to their income. And so we're increasing the amount of those, at some of those pressure points, the amount of the property tax refund. We expect about 42,000 homeowners to be positively impacted by that change in law. And the governor's intention there was to try to target some of this property tax relief at people on fixed incomes who are up against the maximums, who have high property tax burdens relative to their incomes. And I think the PTR, as we all know, is a pretty efficient and effective way of doing that. So that, on the total dollar amount for that, Jack, help me out here, is about $8 million?
$8.5 million,
thank you.
Per year, Commissioner?
Per year.
It actually rises, Mr. Chairman. Starts off at $8.5 million in 2009, and then in fiscal year 2010, it's just over $10 million, and then just over $11 million in 2011.
Sections 25 through 27 pertain to the LGA, and the governor is recommending a 2% increase in the LGA amount. It's about $10 million. That is $10 million a year. It's basically distributed on the formula. The one wrinkle to the formula is that for cities above 100,000, the additional LGA would have to be used for public safety purposes. And that's an idea that we actually adopted from Representative Mullery had a bill. And that basically did exactly that. So we took that idea and ran with it, and the governor thought that was a good idea. I think we'll go from 475 to 485 on the LGA formula.
Commissioner, can you give me the rationale why that's a good public policy to make that decision for those cities?
Well, we had a very robust discussion on this matter in the governor's office, and what we've heard repeatedly from especially the larger cities is that public safety has taken a disproportionate amount of the cuts when the LGA was reduced. And so in order to try to mitigate some of those, we thought it would be best if we required them to dedicate the additional revenue to public safety. Having Representative Mulry represents Minneapolis proposed the idea himself, we thought maybe there'd be some support within the Minneapolis delegation for that dedication.
Senator Waugh.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, one of the things that I've heard that is of concern is that while that may seem like it's a good idea, the very reason why public safety has been so affected, at least for my city anyways, is that the lack of predictability and stability from LGA affects us at the local level in a very harsh kind of a way. And in fact, what we ought to try to do is to try to get local public safety, decouple it from the reliance on LGA, frankly, because, and my city feels that we've treated cities arbitrarily for the last several years and not being respectful enough to make what we give them predictable and reliable. And so in any given year, because of the decisions we make up here that affects LGA, I'm not sure, Representative Mueller might have thought it was a good idea, but I'm not sure that local governments feel that they want to hitch their firefighters and police budgets on something like LGA, which hasn't been too kind to them in the last several years. So,
yeah. Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I think there's an additional philosophical question behind this, and that is the whole purpose of LGA, which was created to support communities that needed to pay for essential services. And the essential services that we agreed upon as on a statewide basis was, you know, public safety, necessary infrastructure. We didn't want cities who couldn't raise their property taxes to go without essential services. And so I think it makes perfect sense to say, if the purpose is essential services, let's make sure that there be these dollars are being used for essential services. Make sure that they're not just going into the general fund and being used across the board. Let's make sure that every community has essential services and the funds they need to pay for them. And I think it's a good philosophy, frankly.
Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As a member of the Minneapolis delegation, I can perhaps would agree with Senator Moi that, frankly, flexibility is more important. As, you know, the city of Minneapolis in particular deals with a variety of issues, and to further hamstring the city with a state mandate on specifically how certain local government aid dollars are spent seems to me to be, overly managing their ability to provide services to their very complicated mix of public services that they provide. And I would hope that we'd try to be sensitive to that as we move forward. I know that, you know, it looks good. It's a good title. It's a good selling point. But on the other hand, I think as a matter of public policy, it's probably not the best direction for us to go.
Senator Squid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to the history of the LGA a little bit, certainly there's a lot of differing aids that have gone to cities. The cities lost their ability to assess personal property tax because the legislature, previous legislators, thought that that was an unfair tax. And what they did is they instituted a sales tax and redistributed that back out to the counties. Now, if we're going to start applying strings to that, you know, the cities didn't have, you know, years before, I'm not sure that that's extremely fair either. The other thing that I would say as we started tying conditions to these aid payments is, you know, perhaps the city will just supplement other dollars for those dollars, and you really won't accomplish anything. So perhaps we should try to get another mechanism to bring public safety to our communities.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
As one who represents a city that's near to approaching 100,000, I don't see a great big problem with this. You know, I think in some respects it's bookkeeping, but I think it does send a message to local councils and mayors that certainly in our more urban areas that that we want public safety. That and I will tell you every time, at least in my city, where the budget cries out, it's in the name of public safety. We can't do public safety. So I don't see this as a great big issue. I suspect to some degree it'll be solved simply in a matter of bookkeeping, but I think it does send a message from the state legislature that in these urban areas public safety is important, not only to certainly local government, but also to state government, and we join in trying to support that.
Commissioner, continue.
Yeah, you know, maybe one other point on the LGA, the $10 million LGA. Senator Mo, your point's well taken about the volatility, and the LGA has been you know, kind of low-hanging fruit when we were going through the tight budget times. You know, the formula, I think, that you guys adopted in 2003, I believe it was, I think, really did a good job of sending the money, that limited resources we do have for LGA, to those places that are most in need and have the highest need factor and the lowest capacity factor. For example, the $10 million that the governor's recommending is going on the formula, and I think about half of that is going to the two urban cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. So I think 2.5 is going to Minneapolis and about 2 to St. Paul. And based on the refrains we've heard from those cities about the impact of the LGA cuts over the last couple years, or 2003 and 4 specifically, so public safety is where the rub came. And so in order to kind of mitigate that and say, okay, here's our $5 million to help restore some of those public safety concerns, the governor thought this was a reasonable approach.
Commissioner, do we know if the legislature had kept its commitment, cities would argue that they should get inflationary increases in LGA. If we had appropriated the inflation to LGA, what would the number be today that we'd be spending on it? And kind of to Senator Moy's point, we're either going to fund LGA and fund the inflation to it or we're not. Do we know what the number is?
Chairman,
how much underfunded are we?
Chairman, we don't have that off the cuff, but I'd be more than happy to get that for you. We'll get that. Absolutely.
Thank you. And the current appropriation in this governor's budget is how much? The LGA?
495 with the additional $10 million. Right. In Section 25 also pertains to LGA. There's been one issue with the formula recently that there's a possibility in certain situations to have a lot of volatility in what a city can get from year to year. And sort of in order to kind of mitigate that year-to-year impact, the Section 25, we call it the volatility fix. So there won't be wide swings in LGA from year to year. And it's more of a blended average between the years. And that should help, eliminate some of those wide swings that go from year to year. And that's something that the League of Minnesota Cities came forward to see if we would help them out with.
Senator Steven.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I just wanted to offer a different opinion of your estimation that the LGA formula has been fair. There are a lot of inner ring suburbs in particular that have been disproportionately hit hard, in my opinion, by the LGA formula remake that was done in 2003. And I just wanted to see if you had any comments about the $10 million additional dollars that the governor is recommending. That obviously doesn't take into account any changes in the formula, if that's correct. But also recognizing that the new formula, if we call it that, now sends approximately 2/3 of the money to outstate Minnesota and 1/3 to the inner cities. And I was just wondering if you had any comments on that or any need, if the governor or the administration sees any need to try to help some of the inner ring suburbs in particular that have been, in my opinion, and others hit rather hard by the new formula.
Senator, Chairman, it's a good question. It's a really good question. I guess I compare today's formula relative to what was pre-2003. And I think most people who have examined the two formulas would say today's formula is a far more rational way of distributing the LGA dollars. Having said that, it doesn't mean that the formula is perfect. And I think we need to revisit the formula every so often to see if it's really delivering the resources where it needs to be delivered. And Jack and I had a meeting a couple weeks ago with a group of city representatives that had exactly your same concern, that the inner ring suburbs aren't benefiting as well as they probably should on the formula. And we very much opened the door to a tweak of the formula or some kind of a recognition in the formula of some of those inner ring suburbs, concerns, city concerns. So it's something we're more than willing to look at. We don't believe this LGA formula is set in stone. It should never be revisited. We definitely think it should, and it can probably be ideal if it was. So we're going to be working with them during the course of the session. If there is a tweak to the formula that makes sense, we would endorse that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I look forward to working with you on that.
Commissioner,
did you want to go through it article by article? Are there some other provisions in Article 1 that we should talk about?
No, I don't think so. I think those are kind of the highlights. Is there something that a member has seen that they want to point out?
Well, we didn't talk about...
Oh, everything's in Article 1, actually. Federal update is Article 2, yeah. I think it's best just to kind of...
Mr. Chairman, that does kind of wrap up the property tax pieces.
Yeah.
Okay.
We could move on.
The next article deals with the military pension. Next section, 12 and 15, the military pension and pay sections, which you are familiar with, I think. I know last year the governor proposed a pension exemption that was phased in over 4 years. This is nearly identical to that. He's also expanded that to also include an exemption for certain pay that it currently isn't excluded under current law. The total cost of that is, I guess, let me see now.
Mr. Chairman, the cost of that in FY08 is $4.3 million, and then FY09, $9.1 million. So it's about $13.4 for the first biennium, and then $34.2 in the out biennium.
And in FY11, what is it?
The total in FY11 would be $20 million. It's phased in over the 4 years.
So and beyond that, we can expect that number to grow?
Mr. Chairman, I would assume that would grow per kind of like inflation.
And it's based on our revenue estimates, would benefit about 35,000 taxpayers. Section 13 is another issue many of you are familiar with. It's the dairy credit. It's very similar to what was advocated for last year. Basically, it's the same dairy credit that the governor advocated for last year. Maximum credit of $50,000. Carry forward period of 15 years. The cost of this is, I believe, $4.8 million a year. Section 14, the regional investment credit, is another idea that's been circulated around the Capitol for the last couple of years. This particular provision is modeled after something Representative Thiessen has advocated. Now, Dan Dorman at one point was also a strong advocate of this, but the governor, it's a recognition that the governor thinks there's not enough venture capital going to small startups, and this would hopefully provide an incentive to direct more venture capital to small businesses. Section 16 is another perennial issue, single sales factor. Back in 2005, I believe, the legislature passed a provision that would, over a number of 12 years, would phase out would also change it to a single sales factor apportionment formula. The governor's recommending that we expedite that phase out and make it an 8-year phase out. Actually, 5-year phase out, I'm sorry. And this is just in recognition that, we're trying to attract as many high-talented, multinational types of corporations here, and this is a really high priority for those folks who compete on a global basis. Section 1820.
Commissioner, on that, what's the cost to that?
It is $4.2 million in 2008, $15.9 in 2009, $23 million in 2010, and then in 2011, $28 million. Yeah, and we were able to utilize one-time money for this just because the phase-outs and current law just pushes it up a few years, shaves 3 years off the phasing period.
Commissioner, at a time when I think we'll get some information from Dr. Stinson later, but corporate profits are running very high right now, I think over what we had forecasted. At a time when corporate profits are running higher than we've forecasted them, why would we want to use our scarce resources to provide additional tax relief?
Well, you know, we've recognized, legislature's recognized, and the governor's recognized that this is probably good public policy. It's in current law. And oftentimes, we're in competition with other states, and this is one of the things they flag. Wisconsin's going to get the 100% sales apportionment formula by 2008. We would like to get there sooner rather than later. This is a kind of tax issue that actually does influence locational decisions, and many times I was over wearing my hat at Deed. This is the kind of issue they would flag for us. How fast are you guys going to get to single sales? We want to locate more property and payroll here. We want to locate more jobs here. This is an issue with many of those companies.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Ennis. If I was to support your argument that this should be accelerated, what would be the cost to going to all of it this year?
That's a good question.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scully, we don't have that number right now, but I'm sure to the committee or maybe yet during the presentation.
Okay, well, that would be great. And I was just thinking, if we did have that one-time money that's available in the surplus this year, and your arguments are correct, you know, perhaps that would be something that the committee would be willing to consider.
And Senator, my recollection is not all that great, but I believe fully phased in, it's just over $100
million
a year.
$100
million. That's my recollection.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very, very respectfully, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to say that your statement was broad in general. I think the larger corporations might be experiencing some profits, but I don't think the middle and lower or smaller businesses are.
I think the question is, what are businesses that are doing business outside the state, what do their profits look like, the businesses that are going to benefit from expediting this? And I agree, as a matter of policy, I mean, that's why we put it in last year's bill, that this is the direction we should move. The question is whether we can, the timing is critical or not, I guess. But Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a similar question on your statement that corporate profits were at record high. They might be. But I was wondering, do you have any information that you could share with the members, not now, but later, on how that breaks down? Is that the large, you know, the top 500 corporations in the country? Is that a national figure? Is that something in the state of Minnesota that we can look at? Is that a result of some of the tax improvements that we've made, this committee has made in recent years? And is it an indication that if a little reform is good and we're beginning to see corporate profits rise, I would tend to think that a lot more people are being employed. And if you look at the unemployment rate, we're at a record good rate right now. And so there is a concept, you know, the old John Kennedy tax proposal that says a rising tide raises all boats. That might be a good thing. And I think we need to analyze those demographic figures that you referenced. That way we might be able to get an indication of where we should go in the near future. If you have any of those record high statistics, I'd like to look at them and break them down. Sometimes the corporations that are just very small, the ma and pa type businesses out there, may not be doing so well. Or maybe they're riding the tide right along with the big guys. So I'd like to know a little bit more about that, because I think that would benefit everyone on this tax committee to see where we go.
Senator Limmer, I don't believe I said corporate profits are at a record high. I believe I said that money's coming in faster in over what it was forecasted to be, and significantly, actually. But I certainly wouldn't characterize it as to be record high. If I said that, I misspoke. But they're coming in over what we had forecasted. Commissioner, is it possible to get a breakdown of what corporate profits are by size of corporation in some kind of deciles, or can the department do that?
I will check and see if we have the capability of doing that. But your point's well taken, Chairman. I mean, our most recent revenue update was about $50 million above expectations for tax collections, and almost all that was attributable to the corporate income tax.
And, Senator Limmer, that's a good thing. I mean, as a guy who negotiates labor contracts for a living, when businesses make money, you can get a little bigger piece of the pie. So I certainly don't object to that. I just kind of question from a policy standpoint if an area of our economy is doing pretty well, and whether it'll stay that way, who knows. But if it's necessary to, when we have limited resources, we need to invest in schools and other things, if providing additional tax relief to them is a good use of current resources, and we certainly will have that discussion. Senator Langston.
Mr. Chair, there was a business group that went around the state here a while back. They were in Alexandria, and they said by far the biggest business problem in the future was a lack of skilled labor. And so I think we have to, even though they may have record or high profits and so on, when it comes to hiring, there are certain people that they need to hire. And so it really does seem like preparing their workers with the proper education and technical training is probably the number one issue that they're dealing with.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
If I could, I just want to make sure we distinguish between corporate income tax revenues and corporate profits. They are two entirely different things. That income or taxes that are paid get paid before you recognize any profits. So we don't know just by the revenues that we're going to see profits in these corporations. And so I think we should just be cautious. The reports that we've seen are increased revenues, not necessarily profits.
I believe there's a correlation, though, Senator Orman. And there certainly should be. Or probably some of those companies should be looking for a different CEO, I would think.
Well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, if the profits don't get declared or seen until after the income tax, we may be taking too much of the profits or all of the profits in too high a tax burden. So I would just say we should look at those numbers. We should see if we can correlate profits to the corporate tax structure and then take it from there. That would be my recommendation.
I don't want to get too bogged down in the numbers. Commissioner?
Thanks, Chairman. Sections 18, 22, and 23 pertain to the capital equipment exemption, upfront exemption. Any of you have sat on this tax committee for any length of time know that this issue about the purchase of capital equipment are exempt, but the business has to apply for a refund to the Department of Revenue. They got to wait 120 days. It's an administrative headache. It's a nuisance for businesses. So we want to make some progress on that. So we've carved out two areas to apply for an upfront exemption for the capital equipment. One is a direct response to the report that was done in response to the timber industry concerns up north. And so we're carving out that industry and saying they will no longer be subject to the refund process. And then we're also trying to make some progress on small employers, because as a general rule, the small employers are the one that it's the most of a nuisance and a headache for. And so for employers with less than 20 employees or less than annual revenues of $1 million, they also will no longer be subject to the refund process. And hopefully over time, with some more one-time money, we can phase this out entirely and allow them to have the upfront exemption across the board for all their non-taxable purchases. And so we just wanted to start making at least some incremental progress on this issue. And it's really a primary and a concern for small employers who just don't have the capability in-house to process these refunds. And it is really a burden for them. So we want to make some progress there. Sections 19 and 21.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Innes, or Commissioner, did you have a cost on that?
Yes. Upfront exemption for the small business part of it is about $5.4 million in the first year, $3.1 million in the second year, and then $2 million. And then for the wood products industry alone, it's $1.6 million, just over $1.6 million the first year, $830,000 the second year, $280,000 in the third, and $80,000 in the fourth. And
thank you.
For the most part, it's mostly a one- or two-time cost. There's a small tail that goes out. I think there's certain folks that just never apply for the refund, and so that's money that the state will be losing on a more permanent basis.
Commissioner, I do think from a policy standpoint we're headed in the right direction here, and I appreciate the governor putting this in. If we can do more, depending on our resources, I think we probably will try. But do I recollect that the department in previous testimony has had some concerns about upfront exemptions and whether things might be purchased that don't qualify and how you might be able to make sure that the intended result is what we intend, I guess, and that has the department's position changed? Because I thought the department supported the refund program rather than an upfront exemption in previous years.
Can you respond? Mr. Chairman, no, the department has kind of supported an upfront capital equipment exemption for a long time. Just the administrative burden and a lot of these smaller businesses that really are entitled to this tax benefit aren't claiming it because they don't have the staff and so on. So we really think from a policy standpoint, this is the way to go. And then if there are issues like that, we can always address those on audit. I think one of our bigger concerns is when there's an upfront exemption for contractors when they're working on a project. You know, it's hard to determine whether all those materials are actually used in the project. So that's kind of where we get a little more concerns, but we do support the upfront exemption for both the taxpayers and the department and just think it's a good policy.
Sections 19 and 21 are sales tax exemptions for MnDOT. Two exemptions in particular. One would exempt commuter rail construction. So this is really applicable to the North Star, the line that runs from downtown to Big Lake. And that has a cost of $4.6 million in the first year and $3.1 million in the second year. The other exemption is for transportation purchases from the Trunk Highway Fund, and that has about a little over $4 million annual cost. And that's just a recognition that here we are applying sales tax to purchases that, you know, public purchase that we're purchasing, trying to make our transportation dollars go as far as possible. So those two are in the tax bill. Section 20.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I was handed a copy of the list of sales tax exemptions at one of my town meetings and pointed out to me that local governments and state governments outside of Minnesota are exempt. And I was wondering if there was a rationale for that or if you'd want to talk about that exemption just a little bit. If you can't today, maybe we could talk about it at another time.
Yeah, you know, I'd be more than happy, Chairman, Senator, to talk about that. Ideal world, but we had another $100 million to get rid of that exemption or that tax, we would. I mean, it doesn't make any rational sense from just a public policy tax viewpoint that be taxing local units of government, but having them pay sales tax on their purchases. But it's about over $100 million budget item. And so it definitely was on our list for consideration.
But Mr. Chair, Commissioner, you missed the point. The point is we are charging sales tax to local units of government in Minnesota,
right,
but local units of government outside of Minnesota are exempt. And I was curious as to what the rationale was for that.
I guess I can't speak to that. I'll have to get back to it at a future time.
Yeah, I'd look forward to having a little conversation about that. It was on the list of exemptions at the department, the new list that was forwarded out this year.
Okay.
Senator Lemire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Innes, I'm kind of curious about this particular provision. For about 5 years of my political life here, I've carried bills to repeal sales tax on political subdivisions purchases. Why should we tax government when it all just gets routed back into the system anyway? And I guess maybe the word amused is what I come up with on the commuter rail purchases. If it's good for commuter rail, why isn't it good for every other political subdivision purchase? I think early estimates years ago was something like $180 million about 4 years ago. And I've run it into this committee so many different times and always with the same result. They want to keep that cash flow. And there doesn't seem to be a constituency out there that's necessarily feeling as though they personally are getting gored by the tax. And so even though I'm in favor of getting rid of sales tax on government purchases, this is one step in the right direction. I wish we could go further in all of our tax proposals as we create them, because I think we really have to look at that. And when you really look at it, and that by the time, I think it's a temporary desire to have the cash flow, but once we get over that decision and we don't rely on it anymore, then we can proceed, and that's pretty much a wash. Matter of fact, it's better than a wash. But, do you have any other elements in this plan that would reduce or get rid of sales tax on government purchases?
Not that I'm aware of. Those are only two in this tax bill. I don't believe there's anything else interspersed with the governor's budget. These are the two. And Senator Lemire, your point's well taken. I mean, it doesn't make any rational sense to be taxing our local units of government for sales tax purchases. But when we looked at it and we looked at the cost of each one, we couldn't make that jump with the budget resources that we had. But your point's well taken, and I hope we can revisit that issue sometime.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean to carry Senator Betzold's water for him, but when he used to sit in this chair in this committee, he used to handle that subdivision. He said it's very expensive price tag, $128 million to do that. And I've carried bills for my locals, too, to exempt them, and I had to take that spoonful of medicine.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, for the last couple of years, I've carried the Carver County Courthouse exemption, and the members of this committee who've been serving with me would not, they would not forget that that has always been uppermost because of the bonding aspect of it. I've always thought that we should, if we're investing in long-term infrastructure, exempt the sales tax expenses, because then you're paying interest on the sales tax at these local levels, which doesn't make any sense. But I always, the request was like hitting a brick wall in this committee, because the answer was, Senator Ortman, if we have to do that for your courthouse, we have to do it for everyone in the state of Minnesota. And so I learned that lesson. I was, like Senator Johnson said, I was given that spoonful of medicine, and I took it. I do think that transportation costs have increased so much, and transportation is our biggest logjam at the Capitol right now. How are we going to get these projects done? And so I didn't get mine. I still want mine. I think we should do all of it, but if we can't, I do think that we should consider exempting long-term transportation infrastructure investments. It's at least something to consider for the short term, because this is a real need, and these projects shouldn't be stopped for lack of the dollars for sales tax.
A lot of good ideas out there, members. Commissioner?
Thanks, Chairman. Section 20 is a sales tax exemption for an expansion that out in Thompson Weston, located in Eagan. Now, this is, you probably read the paper today, this is finally made public. We were sworn to secrecy until today, but this is a great opportunity for the state of Minnesota. Thompson West is contemplating a major expansion at one of three facilities in the country, and Eagan is in the running. And so we came forward with a couple ideas that kind of narrow, make us competitive relative to the other sites being considered. We're looking at first phase, 2,000 jobs being created. If we're fortunate enough to get the first phase, our opportunities to get the second phase are much enhanced. And the total expansion is 5,000 employees. These are high-end, high-wage earners, knowledge-based economy type of workers, average salary, 70,000 plus, software engineers, finance folks. I mean, this kind of expansion is on par with what we did for Medtronic. Now, Thompson West's needs were a little bit different. They didn't need a major transportation upgrade like Medtronic needed. They needed some other things. And so the one thing we thought we could help them out with was a sales tax exemption on the construction materials attributable to first phase. And so that's what that section is.
Commissioner, is it more than just the construction material? I mean, I'm just reading the summary. It reads to me like we're doing more than a sales tax exemption on just construction material.
It is. It's actually construction material and also personal property attributable to the data centers is probably the other big ticket item. There's two data centers that'll be part of this expansion. And as you probably know, that the construction part of that is probably not the big part. It's the actual personal property that's located inside the facility. So it would include that. I think the total cost over 4 years, this expansion would actually take 4 years to facilitate, is about $9 million for the total sales tax exemption. And it really was a recognition. The two other sites they were looking at, the one area we fell short is that they had excess building capacity, these other two sites. In Eagan, they're at full capacity, so we have to build a new, expand on the facility. And so in order at least to make ourselves competitive on that metrics, we thought the sales tax exemption was a reasonable thing to do. So you don't get many opportunities like this to have a major global competitor do a major expansion in your state. And so we wanted to make ourselves competitive, at least have a shot at it. And so with this sales tax exemption, we have a shot.
Well, Commissioner, that's an exciting project, and I did meet with them about the project, had a chance to look at it. I don't know if the governor made commitments but I thought I read or heard that they're going to break ground on at least part of this in April, well before we're going to pass our bill. But are there other tax provisions that the project is relying on in addition to this that this committee is going to see?
Now, the only other provision that would be under the purview of this committee would be there will be a tax increment financing legislation similar to what was done for Medtronic. Expanding, I think, that the duration of the TIF district. So there'll be that special legislation for tax increment financing. Those are the two legislative provisions. I think they've also going to attempt to secure some job training dollars from our Job Skills Partnership Program. One of the, these are highly trained people, and they always need to upgrade their education. So and then they'll be working with the Job Skills Partnership and the MNSCU system to secure some job training dollars too. But as far as legislative issues, the two of them are the sales tax exemption and the tax increment financing.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, does the this particular business have any competitors in the state of Minnesota?
You know, I don't believe so in the state of Minnesota, and they are one of the, I mean, they are a dominant force in their field, and they probably are the dominant force in legal research.
Reason I ask is that if there was a competitor, and I'm saying this more for other discussion in other areas, if there was another competitor, then we would be giving a definite financial advantage to one corporation at the expense of another. And I would be very cautious about going in that direction. The other question I would have, and this kind of little flashbacks of Twin Stadiums and Viking Stadiums, and if we don't give the money, do they leave? Do they not go forward? Could you give us a little indication of what their intent would be if we did not go forward with this public policy?
There's certainly, Senator, Chairman, they're certainly not going to leave. They have a great, they have 6,000 employees in Eagan. They are, Eagan is the largest West Thompson West campus, and it's its most profitable campus. So they got a major presence. They're going to be here regardless of whether this expansion goes through. But the opportunity to secure another 2,000 to 5,000 jobs and really become, I mean, I would call the epicenter for Thompson West, even though it wouldn't be the corporate headquarters, is such a rare opportunity that we wanted to seize it. And your point about, you know, competitors is a good one. Having said that, though, you know, Medtronic did a major expansion in Moundsview. Great project, 3,000 to 5,000 employees, bioscience jobs. You know, they have two other competitors located right here in Minnesota. But I still think it was the right thing to do. Those opportunities are so few and far between that you got to do what you can to kind of secure those. So we're really excited about Thompson West. They're not gonna leave their current place there. They got a great operation, high-functioning operation, but it does provide us an opportunity to do a major expansion out there, and these are great jobs.
Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Commissioner, could you maybe either have someone from the corporation or perhaps someone in your office give me a breakdown of when the public's investment of not, we're not going to collect tax, certain taxes from this corporation in lieu of an expansion of job growth, where would be the break even for the state taxpayers? Is it a year out, 2 years out, 5 years out? And then because now there's more income tax generated, there's more business taxes generated from this particular corporation, at least we can have some idea of where do we get a return on the dollar, as opposed to, let's say, and I think someone can make a pretty good argument in other investments that we've given in light of stadiums or anything else, we don't always look at that. And I would like us to start looking at that. If you have any information, I'd like to you share that.
Senator Limmer, Chairman, I will definitely get back to you on that. I know we Thompson West have crunched some preliminary numbers on that, and I'll get those confirmed for you. But my understanding was that the income tax alone on the new employees that would be housed out there would pay as much as a sales tax exemption within a year or two. Yep. The ROI on it, the return on investment, was very high. And so I will double check that and confirm that and get back to you, Senator.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm a little bit slow on the uptake here. What is the timetable that the company is looking at to make their decision on where they're going to be locating? And then I just want to make sure I'm clear in following up on the chair's question about, you know, whether we'll be done with the session in time to offer them the enticement to stay in Minnesota.
You know, I'm not exactly sure about when they want to break ground, but the governor and the administration, we've been very clear with them that this is a collaborative affair and that we can propose something, but the legislature needs to act on it, and that's, you know, May 23rd is probably when they, you know, somewhere thereabouts is probably when we'll have a final determination about that. I know that their board has given them preliminary approval to at least start preparing to go forward. And I think a lot of that is contingent on what happens here as far as the tax increment financing and the sales tax exemption. I can get you more details, Senator, about exactly what their timeline is. I know this is this first phase. The sales tax exemption goes over 4 years because the logistics of building two data centers and an office building is pretty intense. I think they were quoted to me, it takes 300 electricians to work on one data center. And so you can't build two data centers at once. There's not enough electricians, so you gotta sequence it. But I will get you a better understanding about what the timeline is, when they really need to have the shovel in the ground to make this work. If there's any time constraints on anything, I will send it. I will get that to you. I'll let you know.
Thank you.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, if this doesn't apply to somebody who has a fully executed business subsidy before the agreement becomes effective, I presume if they think it's going to pass, they're going to just delay until it passes.
You know, I can't speak for them, Senator. I expect that this we were told that this is what the tax increment finding, the sales tax exemption, made Minnesota competitive. That combined with our great workforce and the fact they already have a really good high-functioning campus here kind of tipped the balance for Minnesota. But these two components are important to making it feasible for Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Marty.
Commissioner, any business that's planning to build here would be wise to ask for this. And we have no way of measuring what their real factors are. And I guess I just have problems because it's always inequitable. Somebody else, even if they don't have a competitor in this field, and somebody's paying less in taxes, somebody else is picking up the tab. And I guess I just think it's the whole Jobs E concept, the whole concept that we're doing here strikes me as grossly unfair. And a business that's more able to persuade people, hey, we're going to decide based on this, are the ones who get the subsidies, not necessarily those who would really make the most difference for.
Commissioner, I assume representatives of Thompson West are watching. I think it might be helpful for them to spend some time visiting members of the tax committee in their offices so that people clearly understand, you know, the proposal.
Chairman, duly noted.
Continue.
The last section I want to touch on is Job Z. And this would essentially make the Job Z program permanent. Well, it still has the sunset date is still in effect for 2015, but this would say once you sign the subsidy agreement, you get 10 years of Job Z benefits. As you know, the way the program's structured right now, the clock is ticking, so every year that passes, you get one less year of Job Z benefits. This would essentially say from the moment you sign the subsidy agreement, you get 10 years. And so this would make the program at least ongoing until 2015, and then it would give an opportunity for the legislature to revisit the program and see if it needs to be tweaked or continued. And then the second article of the bill is the federal update, which you're all familiar with, and hopefully I think tomorrow you guys are going to take that up on the Senate floor and pass year one at least. And this bill as it currently is drafted has both year one and year two in it, because we weren't sure about what was going to actually transpire. So hopefully we'll get that year one passed and get to the governor's desk on Thursday and save a lot of confusion and complexity for taxpayers and get it out the door. But it will be an issue to deal with for year two. In your committee, Senator.
Commissioner, barring something that the chair doesn't know about, that bill is going to be up on the calendar Thursday, will then be sent back to the House because it's a House file.
Right.
And should be on the governor's desk before the end of the month, I would think.
Yep. We're hopeful. We're hopeful. That's good. And thank you for your help on that.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, are there a couple of update provisions here that aren't in the bill that's going to be on the Senate floor?
I don't believe me. Help me out, Jack, if there is. I think it's just it's verbatim exactly what was on the Senate floor. You guys have already discussed.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I was wondering about Section 6.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Haugen from the Department of Revenue. If you look at our section by section of the federal update, there's a bunch of bullets, where they list the federal changes that we'd be picking up. If you looked at those bullets, the first 16 bullets are all effective for part of 06 or some part of, or are retroactive back to 06. The last bullets from there, from the 16th one on, those are all things that kick in 07, so they wouldn't be in the bill that you're looking at on Thursday.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hogan.
So, Chairman, I think that completes the walkthrough of the governor's tax bill. If you have any questions, I'm more than happy to do my best to field them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Steven.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. To go back to the job zone section, I don't know if you have this readily available, but can you talk about the number of jobs created under the job zone program?
You know, there's been almost 300 agreements entered into. I think we're close to 300 agreements entered into. I believe it's, I got Paul Moore here from Deed is here. He can speak more intelligently to the actual job creation numbers. But I know it's, there's a certain number of jobs that have been we've been retained, and there's another certain number of jobs that we are new jobs. And I think Paul can speak to that.
I have a handout, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, Paul Moe, Department of Employment and Economic Development. Senator Sieben, jobs he created in 2003 became effective for businesses that signed business subsidy agreements in 2004 thereafter, so we're actually now in our fourth year of the program. For the years 2004 and 2005, we had some 3,600 jobs that have been actually created as a result of those projects and those agreements, representing over $300 million of capital investment. The average wage paid by those jobs that have been created is $14.99 an hour. And that takes us through 2004 and 2005.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you. And, sir, I guess that's what I'm getting at more is what the – I know you gave me what the hourly wage is, but do you have any breakdowns in terms of what different categories of jobs? Because I know that you know, regardless of income – some taxes are exempt from the wages there, and I'd be curious to see a breakdown of different levels of jobs and the different wages that are that have been in the jobs that have been created.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, the handout shows at least by hourly wages by category, and there's a breakout of number of jobs by wage band, if you will. So you can see the majority of these jobs have been paying $10 an hour or more. And additionally to that, a majority of these projects are manufacturing sector type jobs, value added.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. You mentioned that there are a handful of other provisions that aren't in the tax bill that are part of the governor's proposal. And as we went through the proposal, I noticed that the provisions being sought by the Mall of America are not in the bill. Are they in another part of the governor's budget? Is that addressed by the governor's budget?
They are, Senator Larson, Chairman, they are not in the governor's recommendations budget. We have been briefed on them, but it was very much as a preliminary discussion about what they were thinking about. It never reached the stage where we even contemplated putting it in the governor's proposal.
Thank you.
Mr. Moe, if this committee is going to consider changes to Job Z, I think if you could put some kind of a presentation together for the committee, and we maybe could spend 15 or 20 minutes on it, kind of on a statewide basis, where the jobs have been created and kind of in what sectors a breakdown. Having carried the legislation in 03, I'm becoming increasingly skeptical of its impact. And, you know, I only know the area I live in. It hasn't done what I had hoped. So I think an overview for the committee kind of on the whole program and kind of what's been happening. Have there been some diminishing activity because of the phase-out, I think would help the committee make a good decision about whether we should go forward with a 10-year.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to do that, and we'll come back at a subsequent date.
When you're ready, just let our staff know. Commissioner, anything else?
I think we walked through the entire bill. If you have any questions, if you have any questions offline, don't hesitate to call us.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Hansen here? There he is. Commissioner, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And by the way, thank you for accommodating us and Dr. Stinson. He had jury duty last week. I know you wanted to do the forecast last week, and I think he showed up for about 4 days and he didn't get called once, but I think he was looking forward to doing something. But he'll be here in just a few minutes. I think you had wanted us to do the forecast.
Correct.
After this. Okay. If I could draw your attention to, we have a packet of slides that Mr. Showalter and I will be referring to throughout our presentation. You will see on the bottom of the first page budget highlights. There is $34.4 billion proposed in general fund spending in fiscal year 2008-2009. And that includes over $1 billion that was included in the November forecast that was issued this past November. It's about a 3.2% increase over the base in 06-07. And that represents primarily human services. There'll be a chart later on in the presentation that'll show you the breakdown, but that is primarily human services increases. When you add up the that $1 billion with the overall increase in spending of the governor's budget, it represents 9.3% over the 2008-2009 biennium. Now, that's over a two-year period, and it also you also have to factor in the cost of inflation, which I think, and there's been a lot of debate about that in the last few days and few weeks. It's very important to consider, you'll see the next point on the slide, that if you factor in the CPI, it's CPI is 4.2% for 2008-2009, or roughly a billion or a little more. There's also another, as Dr. Stinson may mention later on, there is the local and state price deflator, which is a little higher, and which would add another $430 million per year. So when we put our budget together, we considered that thought never left our mind. And as I will get into in a little bit, you will see on the bottom line in 2010 and 2011, we left almost $1.1 billion to cover inflation in the out biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, of the 9.3% increase, how much of that is one time and how much of that is ongoing?
We put a, I think if you were to add up, it's $671 million of money that's phased in or one time.
That's the one time.
Yes. When we, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think the easiest way for me to think about it, and hopefully it would be useful, is that the forecast growth is ongoing. That's about 3% growth. There's another 3% that is essentially structural that is ongoing as well, and there's about 3% that's one time. And so if you look at sort of the governor's budget, it sort of follows that same path, so that about 6% of the growth is pretty much structural, and then the last 2 to 3% is essentially one time in nature or diminishing. That doesn't have the ongoing effect.
Concern, then it would really be the structural that is the most important to look at, and that probably is very much in the just with inflation, 3% a year or something, rather than the 9.3 for 2 years. It's real money being spent, but it's not committing yourself to that much of an increase in the future.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is absolutely true. I think we have several different ways of looking at it, and we try to present a number of different ways to understand either biennial change, because you're right, it is real money, but then on the other hand, trying to understand what is the impact for this biennium as well as for next biennium and the different ways of looking at it, whether it's growth from forecast base or other things.
Okay, if I could, if you could turn to the second page, the top slide. This is a concise snapshot of the whole budget. The beginning balance, the $2.1 billion, represents the money we are carrying forward from 06-07, the over $1 billion, plus the budget reserve, plus the cash flow account. Forecast revenues are revenues we're collecting. You see the subtraction for the governor's initiatives, and you get the total revenue figure of $33.3 billion. Then you see the forecast spending, the total of the governor's initiatives, and you get $34.4 billion. And the difference between 34.4 and 33.3 is roughly the money, the one-time money that you carry forward from 06-07. On the bottom of page 2, you see the a little graphic presentation of the $2.9 billion, or 9.3% increase. And the way I look at it, it's you essentially have the 2.1 that's available for spending in 2008-2009, and then you add the money you're carrying forward from 06-07, and you get the 2.9. or the 9.3% as the package of money that you have available for our decision-making this session. If you factor in the Trunk Highway Fund and the Healthcare Access Account and the federal funds and all the other myriad of other special revenue accounts, that 9.3 slips back to 8.6. And again, the 9.3, it's over a two-year period, and you have to keep in mind that government costs, the things we buy, the things we do, cost more every year. And a portion of what the governor's budget does is take into account and pay for things that cost more in 08-09 over 06-07.
Senator Squay.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Hansen, well, to that point, you know, we're recognizing inflation. Why don't we do that in our forecasting so that it's in the forecast that's presented as what money is available? Because, as you just said, inflation occurs, and shouldn't we be recognizing it in the forecast?
Well, if you look, Senator Scoy, Mr. Chair, on the front, and I actually have a copy of the third paragraph talks about the amount of inflation. This was our forecast in November, and it says adjusting for inflation would add $1 billion to $1.2 billion to fiscal year 2008-2009. This is the book that came out. And then as you go through the document, there's even a discussion about the local and state price deflator that talks about the additional $430 million a year that some economists believe we should be adding and considering. And then there's also a detailed discussion of the Council of Economic Advisors meeting that occurs every couple weeks, you know, before every forecast. As I looked back to the 90s and I looked through some of the old forecast books, about the only thing I saw missing was a chart in the back that took the 4.2% or whatever price or inflation figure that was taken and just applied it to state government, to public safety, to the different categories. I think it is more of a, it's good that we are talking about it. It's a public expectation setting exercise. I know you're getting the same letters that I do and from stakeholders, and there's this perception that everybody is going to wind the clock back to prior to 2003, and that's just not possible. The resources aren't there considering what's happened over the last 4 years. And I've tried, and I know the governor has tried, to help establish those expectations. It's not realistic that unless you add revenues to accommodate all that spending.
Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I certainly agree with you that the expectations are higher than we're going to be able to accomplish, and it seems to me that if we were being more realistic in our presentation to the public as a whole about what is happening to the dollars of the state and how inflation affects them, that some of those expectations might be more in line with what reality is.
Mr. Chair, one more comment. The inflation factors are, if you talk to Dr. Stinson, they're just estimates. I think if you have an over-reliance on it also in the forecast without the debate we're having, you lead people with the impression that government should, every service or everything we do should automatically be inflated. And the way we did it this time, I think it worked pretty well. Everybody was aware of it, but we forced agencies and stakeholders to come forward and legitimize why they need that extra increment of money. I know the Senate has talked about spending some time in February in the first part of session on zero-based budgeting, which is really good, but this is a nod towards that type of concept. Rather than automatically applying a price inflator, you make agencies, you make government aware of it, but make them justify that 2%. And you'll find that maybe people come forward with some good ideas to do it more efficiently.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, if you don't, this 1.0 to 1.2 billion for inflation, that's the CPI. What's the other version? What would it be if we use the implicit?
It is the price. It's on page 8 of the forecast book, but it's called, where is it on here? Price of government, state, and local. It's not the page 8 of your slides, but. I'm referencing the, you don't have this. This is the forecast document. But it's, it would add $430 million a year additional to the figure, to the $1 billion. So it'd take you up to about 1.8.
Mr. Chairman, one point, up to 1.6?
1.8 billion. I'm sorry.
1.8?
Yeah, that's it's 430 for 08, 430 for 09.
Oh, for each year.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator, the PGSL, which is the Government Purchasing Goods and Services inflation percentage, adds about a half percentage to the rates that we show under the CPI. In the forecast document on page 8, we show the estimated inflation based upon the CPI 2008 through 2011. And so I think by 2011, we were estimating inflation at about $1.3 billion. That's, again, not having a budget on the table. That's just taking inflation and inflating 08, inflating 09, continuing to inflate in 10, continuing to inflate one more time in 11. So we've inflated it four times over. So that number was $1.3 billion. We'd add another $430 million to that. So total inflation in 2011, not looking at a budget, would be about $1.7 billion.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langston.
On this graph on the general fund budget, you got debt service and other at 2.9. Well, I know the debt service was, 2.7 or less. What is the other?
What's that? What page are you looking at, Senator?
On the on page 3, on the graph there, and down at the bottom, it says debt service and other 2.9. And I know the debt service was less than that, and I wonder what the other is that's been added to it.
You're one step ahead of me again, Senator. You're on page 3.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's not much else in there. I'm not quite entirely sure. We can try to look it up. It's basically anything else that's left. I'm not sure if that's dedicated revenues or not. But I can check that out for you, Senator.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I understand your argument on the position that you have on inflation. Why would you not count it on expenditures, but you do count it on the revenue side? It seems like a crack in the philosophy there that we are going to make agencies and programs justify increases, but we're sort of counting built-in increases based on revenues. Can you respond to that and tell me, you know, how that matches with your philosophy?
Well, I have when it comes to the inflation discussion, actions, in my mind, speak louder than words. We put a budget on the table that leaves almost $1.1 billion on the table available to accommodate the CPI in 10 and 11. And we mentioned it and talked about it in November, but when we actually sat down and made the decisions, we respected the fact that things are going to cost more, and we left the money available. I would say that a statutory change is not probably wouldn't change what we're doing all that much. It probably the laws works well the way it is, and we have budgeted and allowed for that money. So we count it for revenue, but we, by leaving the structural balance in 10 and 11, we count inflation as well. If we had never mentioned it and denied it, then I think you'd have more of an argument that there is a disparity between the two.
Sir, let's go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. So you're recognizing the inflation. You're just not trying to predict where it's going to occur, and you're leaving it all in one lump on the bottom line. Am I getting that correct?
Inflation, when economists estimate, they don't take it to that. They don't determine whether the price of Senator Langseth's cup costs more for the Senate to buy in 2009 or 2010. It is an aggregate number that is applied to the package of goods and services in government. And then that figure in the past has been then associated with public safety, whatever the number is. They, you know, in the forecast document, it's inflated by one more, you know, whatever that increment is. So it's an important planning tool, and it's we do a better job at it in Minnesota than they do in a lot of other states, but over-reliance on it to the point of that micro level is as much a danger as not applying it at all.
Senator, go ahead.
And this will be my last question, or maybe this is just more a comment, but I just know when in our business we do our budgeting, you know, we budget the increase in corn, for example, mm-hmm. on one side, and then we budget the increase in fuel and stuff on the other side, and some of those inflationary increases we can't do anything about, so we have to acknowledge them. We try to acknowledge where they're going to occur. The ones that we can do something about, we will look at. And I'm just kind of curious as to how come we're not trying to estimate where that inflation is going to occur, where we can't do anything about it, and make those adjustments. And it looks like you're recognizing that they're there. We're just not targeting the areas specifically that it's incurring, and we're kind of leaving a large amount of money at the bottom. With maybe that's more flexible, I don't know, but that would be my last comment on this issue.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you. What we do then is we take that number, and in for the governor's office and for the administration, November and December is our time for making those type of decisions that you talked about. We take that and we apply. We look at each program. We look at, you know, ethanol payments. We look at debt service. We look at public safety. We look at everything out, not just 2 years, but 4 years. And then we take this information from the forecast and we apply it and we make those judgments as to where the costs are going to go, knowing that the inflator is anywhere from $1 billion to $1.2 billion to possibly larger. And now you will be doing the same thing over the next few months. So it's a guide, but you have to apply it to, like you do when you run your farm. You apply it to fuel. You do all the research, and you, well, gosh, it's, you know, it's going up again in the Middle East, and you make that, and you make a plan for whatever year, 2 years. That's what you do when you budget.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I just could expand on that comment. I totally agree, and just want to point out one theoretical framework that we're going between, and that is forecast versus budget. Because in the forecast, I think it is both the Department of Finance interest, the legislature's interest, the governor's interest, the state's interest, to make sure that we're not trying to do a budget through our sort of estimating of what is the cost, what's the right cost. We're trying to give you a planning tool to give you a general impression as to what the impact of inflation is. You can say it's too low, too high, but we're trying to give you a general tool so that we can recognize some of the impact of inflation. How much you want to finance is completely the process of creating a budget, completely the job of the legislature in passing bills, the governor for adopting and enacting bills. That's a separate thing that we hope that we don't want to get too precise in what the estimation of inflation is. We've bounced back and forth on that in past years. That's been part of the reason why we've ended up late 90s going to just a lump sum, saying this is the general impact of inflation on the budget, rather than trying to get too precise at this line item should have this level of inflation, this line item shouldn't have any inflation whatsoever. We just say, here's a planning estimate, a planning tool for everyone to understand in November. Now let's consider what we want to do for healthcare, what we want to do for education, so on and so forth.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, one of my frustrations when I first got here was this concept that because we were not authorizing or reauthorizing inflationary increases in the budget, we were somehow cutting departments' budgets. And that's, I heard that from everybody through 2003. It was very frustrating, and we were not looking back at these budgets to say, were these budgets and these items within the department's budgets actually impacted by inflation? And so there was an assumption across the board, and yet the inflation that impacts these departments impacts them disparately across the board and then within their own accounts. And so how do we as a legislative body do our necessary oversight if we're going to assume that everybody has been impacted by inflation? It's not in the taxpayer's interest for just us to assume that. And I'm not sure that taking inflation all the way out is a good answer either, because we know what's going to happen and we should be planning for it. But I think that what the governor's commissioner and the department have done here is at least recognized it, set the money aside, and said, we know it's going to hit us. It's just like my family budget. I didn't think that the heating costs were going to go down this year, but they did. They were higher last year. And so I'm going to have a lot of adjustments in my family budget, but imagine doing it on the scale that they're doing it in the governor's office. So I think it's responsible, it's accountable to put that money aside and say, we recognize there's going to be inflation, but no, we don't want to attribute it across the board, because it's not in the taxpayers' interest and their concerns of accountability to just assume that it's going to go across the board when it doesn't. I think that the taxpayers want us to look at each of these departments and justify their budgets.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, when my school districts have higher bills from Minnegasco or XL Energy or whomever, they don't have a choice. And yes, we can choose not to fund it. We can choose, when you were talking about we shouldn't assume, if we hold the budget even, some people say that's a cut, and you're saying, no, it's not a cut. Realistically, it's not a cut in their budget. It's a cut in what they can provide because they have the inflation. And, I mean, I even hear when we're using the CPI of Council of Economic Advisors, and most economists seem to suggest we should use the other factor, and that makes the numbers look even worse. But it seems to me it's a matter of honesty in how you talk about it, and saying that it's a cut. It's a cut in the services they can provide if they've got that inflation that they have to deal with.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
But you've just assumed that there was inflation that was impacting that budget. It's not a cut if the inflation didn't actually impact that budget.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, on average, it is impacting that budget of that school district and every other school district and every other thing here. On average. Yes, there's some that go up and some that go down, but on average, it's that higher index, too.
Commissioner, let's move on.
Okay. One more comment on page 3. If you look at the charts, there's no surprise to any of us that K-12 and higher ed and the tax area and human services. By the time you budget for that, everything else is a lot less and a little bit squeezed. On page 4, you see a graphic depiction of, on the top of the $1 billion in the forecast changes, the 3.2%. You see that human services is a 13.5% increase. And then the other interesting note, at the bottom you will see a 15.6% decrease, Mr. Chair. That is the decrease in spending that we are doing, projecting in 08-09 for not paying, paying off shifts. Remember, we had the mechanism where we paid off the school shift that we finished paying off in 06-07, so the fact that it is not going to be done in 08-09 shows up on a sheet like this as a negative, as a spending cut. And then at the bottom you see, and it doesn't come through quite as well on the copied slides that you have, the lighter shade to the left on each line represents the forecast changes, and then the darker shades on the right are the changes in the governor's budget, and that gives you the total $2.9 billion. And then on page 5, you see just the numbers.
Mr. Chair, the forecast changes, are those like the number of pupils in schools and the number of people in nursing homes that would be taken into account, or just kind of a rough idea what those, the forecast changes are?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's generally the nature of the forecast. What we try to do is in certain areas project the impact of current law, and current law is pretty narrow, well, defined as things that are entitlement in nature. I hesitate to use that word because that's actually a legal word, but where we have enrollment for medical assistance is open. Enrollment for K-12 is open, that when somebody shows up, we must serve them. And certain levels of funding per student, per enrollee are essentially already in law. So those adjustments in enrollment or cost, to an extent that those are also in law, are reflected in the forecast. Most of the change that you see here, nearly all of the change that you see here is related to healthcare changes. About a third of that is, maybe even less than a third, is related to enrollment. The rest is related to some of the cost issues there.
And so, Mr. Chair, it's kind of a usage issue of open enrollment areas.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, on page 5, you see another way of looking at the changes in the governor's budget. This represents the $2.1 billion available for spending, not the $1 billion in forecast growth. So you can see that when you add K-12 and higher ed, our recommendations are over $1.1 billion. The tax relief number is 281. The health care reform is 274, and you see the rest. And then just the final slide.
And Commissioner, did you bring with the breakdown of these spending initiatives where the one-time is versus the ongoing?
Yes, I do. I have.
Yeah, you can hand it out.
Yes, we do have.
We don't have copies of it.
We have a. If somebody can make copies, Senator or Chair, Mr. Chair,
we'll get copies made. Thank you.
And then finally, at the bottom, just a mention of some of the one of the governor's focuses in his budget is rewarding performance, Q comp and Q care, and the nursing facility performance pay items were in past budgets that were augmenting in this budget, and then his successful schools initiative and the U of M MinSCU performance bonus are new portions in the budget. And then on page 6, Mr. Showalter will walk through briefly some of our recommendations in each area.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Showalter. I'm the State Budget Director, and we'll be presenting for you, starting on page 6, some of the specific initiatives that are included here. Essentially, what you're seeing is just some more detail from the slides that the budget highlights that Commissioner Hansen just described on the previous page. And we'll start with K-12. The governor's proposal is, in broad scope, trying to take a system that's already performing well, that schools and students are already measuring well compared to their colleagues in other states, and trying to find ways to continue that progress and trying to find ways to go beyond that. The initiatives that are listed here, we can go into more detail as you'd like, but essentially are trying to find ways to particularly focus on the high school experience, find ways to take the educational experience, academic achievement, so that they're ready either for college or further technical training or the workforce by the time they're getting out of high school. The total package is $714 million. Second slide is in higher education.
Mr. Showalter, maybe before we move on there, do you know how much of the 714 is one time before we get to
I just gave away my sheet. The couple of things that are particularly one time include the performance bonuses. It's the middle item there, the successful schools. It's $150 million. In addition, there's technology initiatives. There's a $33 million and an additional $5 million for a total of $38 million in technology. For successful schools. Otherwise, there's some very small items, including a Mandarin Chinese expansion at $500,000, statewide comprehensive library study at $200,000, rulemaking for grad standards at $204,000, rulemaking for career and technical education at $204,000.
And this will be on the sheet, Mr. Chair.
This is all on the sheet. I'm just reading off the sheet.
So do you have a total? Or
I don't have a total, but it's going to be probably $189 million of that.
Of the 714?
Yes. Maybe 190 by the time you get...
Permanent, Mr. Chair?
Sirmois.
What was that? Was that permanent or one-time?
One-time list, okay. I'm reading.
Mr. Showalter, go ahead.
In higher education, the proposal basically says... once we've got students going through the K-12 experience and are academically prepared for college or other technical schools, how do you make sure that they've got the financial resources to get there? His achieved two proposals start to try to look at student-based need and try to find ways to get resources to those students. There is additional funding for the University of Minnesota as well as Minsky in the package, total of $414 million. The one-time items of note include some Minsky technology funding, roughly $30 million out of a $60 million package. Performance incentives for both the University of Minnesota and Minsky, $25 million for each system. And the UMail partnership funding, one-time funding at $38 million. Quickly adding those up, that's 50-80, about $118 million of that total is one-time in nature. I should note that the one-time investments list that you have here is our best effort to try and create that list on short notice, as well as the phases. You might find some relatively small items that are, as you course through the budget, but I think that this is substantially the story here. That's higher education. On the next page, we're looking at the Next Generation Energy Plan. Really focuses on trying to find ways to take advantage of Minnesota's advantage in some of the renewable energy area and continue with additional research and commercialization. That package has also been announced prior to the budget release. By and large, I don't think there's a lot of one-time spending in there. There's a $40 million total package. ED85, a gas pump grants, I hear from the back. $12 million, that is one-time for that element of that. Healthcare reform, looking at ways to basically continue the current programs and the current obligations that are in current law, that spending grows by over $1 billion, as Commissioner Hansen mentioned earlier. That is included in the governor's budget. There's not reductions to that. In addition, there are some changes recommended in Minnesota Care in creating a health connections enterprise so that people can access private insurance more readily. That total package is about $274 million, and some of the initiatives are shown here. Included in that process would be reducing some of the Minnesota Care premiums, giving them some alternative ways of accessing insurance. Ultimately, should increase the number of children covered by about 13,000 kids. The package also includes some previously proposed initiatives in mental health and other things.
Mr. Showalter, the long-term care provider rate increases, what kind of percentage are we talking about? I know I have nursing homes in my district that are kind of on life support, and I think they're using money from their hospital to subsidize the nursing home. I think it's an area I've got some real concern over. What is the inflationary increase that we're looking at giving to those long-term care providers?
Mr. Chair, the recommendation is for a 1.5% base increase plus a 0.5% performance increase for a total of 2%, which in most instances facilities would be able to achieve.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Moving on the next page, you've already seen and heard more detail than I could provide on providing tax relief, but the quick look at it is that there's elements of property tax relief to individuals, both from property tax and some income tax provisions. Income tax provisions largely have been already discussed and proposed.
Thank you.
Some other notes there. Bottom of the page just notes some of the GI Bill and other proposals to support veterans and those returning from Iraq. Much of that package has been announced by the governor, and we'll go into that in more detail if you would like as well. Not on page 9, you'll see the Ensuring Safe and Vibrant Communities. This is a list of just some of the other notable provisions that are included in the governor's budget. Includes additional troopers funding so that we don't erode the number of troopers, as well as putting some money into increase the number of troopers on our roads. $100 million in one-time money for transportation going to the Trunk Highway Fund, as well as basically feathering in the sales tax on leased vehicles so that that is used for transportation purposes, both transit and roads, in a way that is similar to the MBES dedication that was enacted this November. A continuing housing commitment, $44 million there, some of which is one-time in nature. A permanent clean water initiative, as well as pandemic initiative, $22 million. On the bottom of the page, there are some investments, primarily in the economic development area. You already heard some about the Job Z extension and some of the economic development ideas. There's also bioscience initiatives that are included in the higher education area that are also closely linked to the economic development strategy. To summarize, on page 10, the top slide basically, it just reminds you that about half of the money that is available after the forecast, that is about $2.2 billion after current commitments in the forecast, about half of that money is essentially going to higher education or K-12 education. The rest is going to the rest of state government. Health and Human Services access, maintained and provided, initiatives obviously in energy and other resources. And a number of investments, which I'll get to in a second, about trying to find ways to make sure that we just continue to use our money better. Some of those things include technology and other government reforms that I'll mention in a second. Obviously, there's also a bonding package that was announced. It's a fairly limited package of $60 million, focusing really on emergency items, including the exterior for the transportation building, including some security and armed repairs that are necessary out in Oak Park Heights, correctional facility, other things. Also is a prior commitment to the deck up in Duluth at $38 million. We took, in summarizing the governor's budget, in developing the governor's budget, we tried to figure out how much was available for technology. We don't always tally it all up, and it was actually a very significant number, $213 million that you see here. That includes significant infrastructure improvements for the state, as well as a lot of infrastructure improvements in MNSCU, K-12 systems, things like that going all the way through. Carry forward for technology is one structural thing that you should also be aware of, and this committee would be particularly interested in. As you know, at the end of the biennium, operational money available to state agencies cancels and comes back to the general fund. What we're trying to do is propose that some of the use it or lose it incentive isn't there, that money would be set aside so that clearly the legislature could know what that money would be used for. It would be directed more towards technology purposes, one time in nature, so that it doesn't create ongoing obligations. But it allows the state to plan those projects more effectively and doesn't penalize people for basically trying to manage their budget so that the money works through the entire biennium.
Mr. Chair, just to remind you quickly that on carry forward, the House and the Senate have retained their own carry forward for as long as I've been here without much debate. So,
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for not remembering your name. Is any of the technology investments kind of the infrastructure of expanding coverage, or is it different than that? I'm thinking of, like the wireless network or something, or is it all technology and offices or kind of that? Is there any breakdown on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yeah, we have a detailed breakdown that we can work through. In terms of wireless access, that's not necessarily where some of the key infrastructure areas are. It's data security. If you remember, there was a legislative auditor report a year ago or so talking about security risks within the system that, although we haven't been hacked into yet, there certainly were issues about people being able to access private data in the state systems. I have a significant initiative there of $17 million. Integrated tax system, something that the Department of Revenue will talk about more, of replacing some of the individual standalone systems, creating a more comprehensive, seamless system. First phase of about $16 million for that. IT consolidation and trying to make sure that some of our warehouses and things like that, data centers, are more centrally managed. A number of those types of initiatives. More back office is when I'm talking about infrastructure.
And, Mr. Chair, I guess I was thinking more about broadband to out into the other areas of the state. Is any of that in this, or is it not?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would probably defer to OET for that. There are certainly some initiatives trying to get technology into rural areas, in particular some of the schools initiatives, trying to make sure that all schools have access for online type of opportunities. MNSCU also is having a significant initiative to try and get all of their network and all of their system is available to students. So some of those things, the health initiative on e-health also has a focus for underserved areas, particularly in some of the rural areas. So those elements do access some of that, not necessarily to create broadband networks, more a private sector issue, but to make sure that what technology is already there and have this content in place.
Thank you.
Commissioner, anything further?
A comment about the one-time versus ongoing, Senator. When we began our process, and started our decision-making process, we had the one-time column and the ongoing column, and the numbers got to be about the size of microfiche. So we started keeping keeping track of the structural balance number in 10 and 11, and that's why when we started presenting to you, you know, we had to create the one-time list again. And that's certainly just a different way of looking at it, just because we didn't have it. We just looked at it from a different perspective. But I assume as you go forward, you might in each division have one-time targets versus ongoing targets. So.
Well, I think the divisions all need to know there are kind of two different pots of money, and how they treat it in their spending bill it's got to be treated differently.
Yes. And then just quickly, on page 11, you see at the top, again, a summary of the overall, of the $2.2 billion. That's the general fund money. You see a picture on the bottom of the budget reserve and how we are taking it up to 4% and our goal to take it up to 5%. And then I will turn it over to Jim just for a brief comment on page 12 about the GAAP financial statements.
Mr. Chair, Senators, on the top of page 12, there's just a chart that shows the GAAP basis fund balance. GAAP has come up in the past in past forecast briefings and has come up in legislation as well. It is essentially the generally accepted accounting principles way of looking at the budget. When we present the budget, we always do it on a cash basis. That's the way that most units of government do it, nearly all. However, there's another set of books that basically is an accrual view. That's what rating agencies look at, so that you got a consistent look across states, across public entities. That accrual statement typically has Minnesota with a significant balance. because we would have assets, we would have obligations that we're paying on time, we would have reserves. So if you look at this graph, you see that, you know, even coming into 2002, we had around a gap fund balance of over $600 million. When the deficits hit, we were able to balance our cash budget by shifts, by drawing down our reserves and other mechanisms. What that did was, however, take our gap fund balance down negative, substantially negative. And that was one of the factors that the rating agencies looked at, particularly Moody's, when they downgraded the state from AAA status. Since then, we have worked very hard and I think very quickly as a state to start paying back those shifts, storing the reserves, actually quicker, I think, than many people thought we could. The good news is that the release of the 2005 and 2006 CAFRs basically have suggested that we have started to rebuild and replenish those that gap statement so that we are now in a much stronger position than we were just a couple of years ago. Some of the factors that we've used that have gotten us back there are listed on the left-hand side of the slide.
And then on the bottom of page 12, you see the structural balance numbers in 2010, 2011, and those represent the CPI number that I talked about, not the other standard. And then finally, if you want, you see on the page 13, if you need more information, you go to our website. It has multiple pages on each initiative, and then anything that we can provide you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we will be available to help you in any way that we can.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions, members? Dr. Stinson?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Thank you for coming.
My impression of what you want me to do this morning is to give you a very brief discussion about the forecast that we released at the end of November, and then to give you a little bit of information about where the forecast might be headed at the end of February. There's a handout, says Minnesota forecast and outlook on it, looks like this. And that's what I'm going to be going through. And at the bottom of the first page is the one graphic that kind of summarizes the results of the forecast in November. We had a $2.2 billion surplus, $1,038 million of that came in 06-07, $913 million of that was on revenues, about 2.9% higher revenues than we had forecast, $125 million of that was in spending. For 2008-2009, the biggest contributor to the surplus was the end-of-session balance that was left, which was $737 million. Revenues were up by just under $300 million, or about 0.9% compared to the planning estimates. And expenditures were up about $100 million, or down $100 million. The bottom line is that of the $1 billion that we have in 06-07, $450 million of that came from tax year, fiscal year 2006 at closing. So that means about 20% of this additional revenue is in the bank. The other 80% is still yet to be collected.
Mr. Chair, if I could make a comment on that 2008-2009 number. For those, and I look, and all of you were in the legislature the last 2 years, some in the other body, but that $737 million of additional money, you earned that in 05 and 06 by leaving that on the bottom line and planning ahead. And I know people in the last couple of years have put a lot of emphasis on the discord in the legislature, but one thing that hasn't been is budgeting and looking ahead and planning in the out biennium. So that figure is, in my mind, an important figure because you did earn it.
That's our structural balance.
Yes. That's our structural balance from 05-06, the last biennium, 06-07 to 08-09 that you now get to use and that you planned ahead for.
Mr. Chairman, turning to the top of page 2, this is a little bit more detail on where the revenue growth came from. For the individual income tax, you know, 607, $500 million, about 3.7% more than was forecast. $250 million of that came from tax year 06-07 final payments and refunds. That raised the base level for the forecast, and that base level just carried on forward into tax year 07, tax year 08, and tax year 09. The growth actually was a little slower than was in the forecast in tax year 08 and 09, but because we had a higher base, that left us with additional money. It appears that the additional money that that we got came from capital gains. Now, we still don't have the sample of tax year 2005 tax returns yet. We will in another week or so from the Department of Revenue, so we'll know exactly where that money came from. It appears that that came from capital gains last year. In our forecast, we don't have quite as strong a growth in capital gains. In fact, we don't have very strong growth at all in capital gains for tax year 2006 and 2007. The sales tax was actually below forecast. It was below forecast by $92 million, or about 1% in 06-07, and $154 million, or 1.6%. That's partly a reflection of just weaker than projected sales tax receipts, but there was one other big factor contributing there, and that is that the revenue that was expected to occur because of, or revenue growth that was expected to occur because of voluntary compliance by out-of-state internet vendors because of the streamlined sales tax provisions that have been approved, simply hasn't shown up. We took $36 million out of the forecast for that in 2006-2007. We took $99 million out of the forecast for 2008-2009. And so those are the major contributor to the weaker-than-expected sales tax forecast.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, on that, if I can understand, are you saying that about $50 million was forecasted in terms of, or $50 million more was forecasted in terms of revenues generated from out-of-state internet sales?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, the way to think about it is that there was $36 million more forecast, not forecast, but assigned the fiscal note that was attached to the streamlined sales tax and the voluntary compliance on that had $36 million more for 2006-2007 than has actually shown up in the accounting system. And looking at that and talking to people in the Department of Revenue who monitor this, they indicated that it was highly unlikely without national law changes that there would be any additional money other than just kind of normal growth from the people that are already complying. And so that because of that, we took $99 million out of 2008 and 2009.
Thank you.
Dr. Stinson, is there any way to get better compliance if it's a compliance issue? Anything we could do?
On internet, or Mr. Chairman, on internet sales, it's very difficult. And the way that I understand it, and I don't understand all the intricacies of this, but the way that I understand it is that without states joining this streamlined sales tax and providing some incentive, you're not going to get voluntary compliance. A key state would be the state of Washington, where Amazon.com is located. California would be another key state, and without legislation in those states providing incentives for Amazon.com to comply with other states' sales tax collections, you're not going to get it in the absence of federal legislation.
Thank you. Senator Squire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Sinzen. So I'm hearing you saying that the streamlined sales tax thing is kind of stalled out until there's national legislation or else more states that are in compliance as Minnesota is?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, that's my impression. And again, there are people in the Department of Revenue that we talk to that have given us this information. This isn't something that we've developed independently or anything like that, but that's the sense that I have from talking with people in the Department of Revenue.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson, you gave us the percentages on the sales tax as you're going through this table. Could you give us the percentages for the other categories, also the individual income and the corporation?
Yes, Senator, the individual income tax, 3.7% in 2006-2007 and 2.4% in 2008-2009. Turning to the corporate income tax.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Forgive me, Mr. Stinson, or Dr. Stinson, before you do that, just a comment for the chair. It seems to me that if internet sales continue to grow, our regular sales tax revenues will also go down because people are buying more on the internet. And I would hope that the chair would entertain having more of a conversation about the streamlined sales tax and a presentation from the Department of Revenue about that, about exactly where we're at with that. Because if we've got certain companies voluntarily complying, they may also be impacted adversely by our own policies. So I would hope that we would entertain a larger discussion about that issue.
We, Senator, we'll talk with Department of Revenue and see if we can get them to come and give us some presentation on the streamlined sales tax and the states that are participating and what long-term what the impacts of our sales tax projections are.
Thank you.
I think that'd be helpful for the committee. Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, turning to the corporate income tax, there, as the Senator noted, there are probably huge percentage changes, and there are huge percentage changes. For 2006-2007, it's 18% more than forecast. For 2008-2009, it's 17.4% more than forecast. Those are just gigantic changes in revenue forecast. Part of it's due to huge changes in corporate profits, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later on because that's one of the risks to the forecast. But the other part of it is due to a change in the Department of Revenue's estimates of the cost of the Hutchinson technology decision. For 2006-2007, the department has changed their estimates of the Hutchinson technology cost and reduced it by $107 million. For 2008-2009, they reduced that cost by $64 million. So $167 million in total of that $635 million of positive variance or change in the forecast comes from a change in the estimated cost of the Hutchinson technology decision. The motor vehicle sales tax down $206 million in 2008-2009. A lot of that, but not all of that, is due to the constitutional amendment. that was passed. That's a 40% decline in revenues for 2006-2007. It's a 3% decline. Of that $206 million, about $166 million is because of the constitutional amendment dedicating a portion of the phasing out the motor vehicle sales tax for the general fund. $50 million is just due to weaker than previously projected growth in motor vehicle sales. Bottom line is that there were relatively small percentage changes, some of which were due to changes in technical situations like the streamlined sales tax, like the Hutchinson technology situation, but with relatively small changes, percentage changes, when you're working with a $30 billion budget, 1% is $300 million, and so that's where we stand. The forecast changed very little because the underlying economic outlook really didn't change very much as well. You can see down at the bottom, I think this graph is mislabeled, but I'm not 100% sure now. But anyway, in fiscal year 06, the change was very small, 3.3 to 3.4% between February and November. And the result really is that there was almost no change after you took into account slightly slower real or inflation-adjusted growth and slightly stronger nominal slightly stronger inflation to leave nominal growth at roughly the same level as we had before. Looking on forward to what's going to happen for the February forecast, right now there are four issues that are of concern to the U.S. economy, and if you have paid any attention at all to the business news or the economic news over the past couple of months, you know what they are. They're housing, they're interest rates, they're inflation, and they're energy costs. Housing is the one that we are the most concerned about, and it's the one I want to spend a little bit of time talking about here. Interest rates, the question is, what will the Fed do? Will the Fed raise interest rates? Will the Fed lower interest rates? And in part, the Fed's decision is going to depend upon what's happening to inflation. And with inflation, the question is, has the economy eased enough to relieve any inflationary pressures, or is the economy still going along at such a strong level that it's likely to create further inflationary pressures? And then finally, there's this whole question of energy, and I know you and I have talked about this in the past a little bit, Mr. Chairman, about what the appropriate forecast for energy prices should be, and right now your guess is as good as mine. In the forecast, however, going on out through 2009, Global Insight has energy prices at $60 plus per barrel, and so they're expecting that this brief respite we're seeing in gasoline prices is going to be short-term, and so I guess my advice is that anytime you see gas at the pump below $2 a gallon, you probably better fill up because it might be the last time that you see it.
A lot of people are watching, Dr. Stinson.
That's right. If you look at the bottom of page 3, the housing issue is really the issue that nobody knows what is going to happen because of. U.S. single-family housing starts were at 1.75 million. They've fallen to 1.4 million in the third quarter. We're expecting 1.2 million for the next three quarters, and so that's a pretty steep decline. And sometimes people look at what's going on in the national economy and say, well, yeah, that's the East Coast, that's the West Coast, that's the South or whatever. That's not going to happen. That's not going to affect Minnesota. If you look at the bottom of page 3, you can see that if anything, the situation is a little bit worse in Minnesota and has been a little bit worse. we've gone from 2,500 permits per month at the start of 2006, seasonally adjusted, down to a little bit more than 1,400 permits per month in the month of November. And this is a Minnesota number. This is not a national number. So that's more than a 40% decline that we've seen there. In our forecast, we have that, as you can see, bottoming out in the first quarter of 2006 and then going slightly up from there, but not going back to those strong levels that we've seen the last few years in the forecast horizon. Cost 9,000 construction jobs in 2007 between the fourth quarter of 2006 and the fourth quarter of 2007. In our forecast, we have 9,000 less construction jobs. In our forecast, we have a loss of 2,000 jobs in the lumber and wood products industry. We made that forecast in mid-November. Since that time, as you all know, we've lost more than 1,000 jobs in the lumber and wood products industry just in the last couple of months, the Ainsworth closing, the Anderson Windows layoffs totaled a little bit more than 1,000. So this is serious for Minnesota's economy, and we're concerned about it. One of the benefits, though, for the national economy is that the construction portion of the economy is not a very big portion of the economy. Housing amounts to about 6% of the U.S. economy. So if you have 16% decline, if you drop from 6% to 5%, that means that it costs the U.S. economy 1 percentage point in terms of growth. And so since we normally grow 3 to 3.5% a year, that means our growth rate would be 2 to 2.5% a year. So that's the hope. That's what the hope is that decline, which is going to occur, this 16 to 25% decline is going to occur. You know, it's happening right now, as you can see from these graphs. That's all that happens. The worry is that what happens is that it begins to affect the consumer sector, and that the consumer sector cuts back a little bit. The consumer sector is 70%, 65%, 70% of the U.S. economy. And if we see weaker spending by consumption, that could severely slow the U.S. economy. People aren't calling for a recession, but people that are less optimistic about the housing sector see growth rates between, well, closer to 1% than 2%. Why would this affect the consumer? Well, there are two reasons. One is that a lot of consumption has been financed by mortgage equity withdrawals, people refinancing, taking a little bit of money out and buying a widescreen TV, as well as getting a lower interest rate on their home mortgage. The second reason is that as this progresses, we expect that housing prices nationally will fall by about 3%. Now, housing equity is, for most people, the single largest portion of their wealth, of their stock of assets. And if you have less wealth, you're a little bit less likely to go out and spend, given that you have the same income. And so the question is, how does that that wealth effect work through? And the problem for economists and forecasters is that we haven't ever been here before. We haven't seen this kind of behavior before, because not since the Great Depression have we had over an entire year housing prices actually decline. And so there's all kinds of questions as to, you know, what's really going to happen here, and we'll just have to see how things play out. One of the first indications that we were going to get was Christmas sales. Christmas sales didn't tank totally, but they weren't particularly strong. So it looks like there hasn't been, as yet, a really serious reduction in consumer spending, but we'll be taking a look further on. There are a couple of other items that I want to talk about just real briefly here. At the top of page 4 is a graph that shows corporate profits and the Standard & Poor's 500. And what you see there is that they track each other relatively closely up until about 1997. And then the S&P 500 jumps way up compared to corporate profits, and then it comes back down and starts tracking it again. That's the infamous stock market bubble. You can see how the stock market got way ahead of the underlying corporate profits. Well, now we're in a different situation. We're in a situation where corporate profits are well above the underlying value of the stock market. And there are two ways to interpret this. One is now is a really, 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 really good time to buy stock because the stock market's going to go up and be at the line of the corporate profits. The other is that now is a really, really, really risky time to have all your money resting on corporate profits taxes or anything like that. And that's what we're really concerned about here. If you look at the bottom graph on page 4, what you see is corporate profits as a percentage of GDP. And for the last two quarters, corporate profits share of GDP, of total output in the economy, is at the highest level it's been in the post-World War II period, with the exception of the fourth quarter of 1950, which is the time that we were entering the Korean War. The forecast that we have, we're following the Congressional Budget Office's lead and bringing that corporate profits back down relatively quickly. We're bringing it down to only 10% or 2/10% of GDP, which is slightly above what it's been over the last two decades on average by 2010. But we may not be bringing it down fast enough, particularly if the oil price forecast is not a good forecast. If oil prices decline faster, it's part of this growth in corporate profits has been contributed by the very large profits from the oil industry, and so we're concerned about that.
Senator Ortman, what do you think of these two graphs?
These are pretty interesting. I wanted to ask.
Could you please share them with Senator Limmer? I see he's not here.
I will. That'd be helpful. I promise. Question for you though: is there any way to break this down and make it applicable to Minnesota? You know, when we had the housing starts, we could see, you know, the impact on Minnesota. Is there some way where we can track Minnesota corporate profits as a function of the S&P 500?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, as you know, Minnesota taxes all corporations that have a presence in the state. And so really the best measure for what's affecting Minnesota corporate profits, the taxable corporate profits, which is what we're interested in, obviously, since we do the revenue forecast, is by looking at national corporate profits. And so if you're looking at for a measure of the tax base, this is probably the best measure of what's happened to the Minnesota corporate income tax base. Now, the Star Tribune and I think the Pioneer Press both track the Star Tribune, I know, does this Minnesota 100 on the business page, I think, quarterly. And so you can see the 100 largest corporations headquartered in Minnesota. And you can see what's happening to their profits, what's happening to their revenues, what's happening to their stock value. And I think they do this on a quarterly basis. And so it's probably due before too long, I would guess, for the fourth quarter, actually.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson, could you just expand a little bit about, I thought you said that this is a risky time to rely on corporate profits for forecasted revenues, because there's been an awful lot of profit shown already for or recently, so that may have a reverse effect. Can you just talk to us a little bit about that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, this is a complicated discussion to have, but I'm going to simplify it down real quickly here. In the national income accounts, there's an income account and a product account, and they have to balance. And the way that we get GDP is we add up all the output from all the corporations and all the various sectors and so on like that, and that's national output or product, and then we distribute it so much to wages, so much to proprietor's income, so much to farm income, so on like that, and that becomes national income. Okay, they've got to be equal. National income has got to be equal to gross domestic product. Okay, and so given that you are forecasting all these things, they're not going to be equal. And so you have to have one item to make it balance. And our consultant, Global Insight, and most other forecasters as well, use corporate profits as that balancing item, as that plug number to make things balance. Well, if you're interested in what the forecast is for the iron and steel industry or the motor vehicle industry or something like that, and you get that forecast, it really doesn't bother you to have corporate income as the residual, that's the amount that's needed to balance those two accounts. I mean, it's not something that you're particularly concerned about. If you're a state revenue forecaster, however, where you're getting substantial amounts of money from the corporate income tax, you're really concerned about what is the proper level. Is this a number that's been plugged a lot, or is this a number that's, you know, pretty much what you'd estimate or something like that? That's our concern. That's why we're talking about this, is because this is a plug number, and we're saying that our National Economic Forecasting Service, we're worried about the number that they're plugging in there, that it may be leading us astray. And so in our forecast, we're taking it down in this way.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman, I think Dr. Stinson said it's either risky to depend on increasing corporate profits or it's a good time to buy stocks. So, and I don't know which it is. Maybe none of us do. If somebody does know for sure, will you let me know? Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know we're going on a long time here, but I just, you mentioned that the corporate profits was tied to the price of oil and the high profits was, but you know, for every, or not, what's the balance between the corporations that benefit from low prices of oil versus those that have high, and how does Minnesota fall into that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy. The balance appears to be in the national income accounts that it's better to be a big oil firm right now than anything else, that the profits from production of oil are driving everything else as compared, so that the net would be a loss there. Mm-hmm. For Minnesota, again, you know, we get a share of ExxonMobil's spending, or a share of their profits. We get a share of BP's profits because of the fact that they have a presence in the state. And so in the finance department, we don't see the actual corporate returns. That's information that's kept in the Department of Revenue, but we know that that major oil companies are paying taxes in the state.
Mr. Chair, if I could,
Commissioner,
comment on that chart on page 4 with those dots going down. It's just as important to as we rely on our revenue sources going forward to keep track of whether that revenue will be there as it is to include inflation in the forecast. That's all part of the same formula that we have to work out together.
Mr. Chairman, on the top of page 5, there's another special issue that relates to the long-term economic outlook or the revenue outlook for the state. And the first graph shows what's happened to capital gains realizations between 1950 and 1995. And what you see is there was this huge spike in 1986. In 1985, capital gains realizations nationally were $170 billion. In 86, they were $324 billion. In 87, they fell by 56% back down to $177 billion. Now, I don't think any of you other than Senator Langseth were in office in 86 and 87. But Senator Langseth may remember that a lot of big states, California, New York, Massachusetts in particular, had huge revenue shortfalls at the time because they didn't see this drop back in capital gains coming. What happened was that there was a change in the federal capital gains law, and the tax rate went up in 1987, so logically, everybody that was going to sell stock in 1987, the first part of 1987, shifted it to 1986, and so you had both a huge spike and a huge decline. Okay, if you look down at the bottom of page 5, what you can see is that we are in a similar situation, that under federal law, the capital gains rate goes from the current 15% to 20% in 2011. We have that in our forecast, that change in the law in our forecast. What you see is a spike for tax year 2010 and then a big decline for tax year 2011. Now, what's important for the committee and for legislators to understand looking on out to the planning estimates is that the revenue from that spike in 2010 shows up in fiscal 2011, so it artificially increases the amount of revenue that we expect on a one-time basis in fiscal year 2011, and then the snapback, the decline, occurs in 2012, and that's not as part of our planning estimates because our planning estimates only go out through fiscal year 2011. So that's just a warning that we need to be especially careful looking out at the structural balance in 2011. Real quickly, on page 6, this is what we know in terms of the economic outlook. There's really not much change between January's forecast and November's forecast, so that on the basis of the economy alone, we wouldn't expect very much change if the February forecast is similar to January's. On the revenue side, we had total receipts for November and December were $57 million, or about 2% more than we expected in the November forecast. Almost all of that came from corporate revenue. Corporate miscellaneous revenue amounted to about $49 million above forecast. That's payments that accompany tax year 2005 tax returns or tax returns from or payments that are settlements of prior tax years, so that doesn't have anything to do with tax year 2006 or 2007 outlook. Individual income tax receipts were down about $5 million from forecast. Right now, withholding, our biggest single source of revenue, is just slightly below forecast. Sales tax receipts were down about $7 million compared to forecast, but that only included sales tax receipts paid in the month of November, for purchases made in the month of November. We're waiting now to the end of this month to see what happened to December sales, and that'll be a crucial part of the forecast. So there's still a lot of information to come between now and the time we do the forecast, but at this point, the forecast looks largely on track.
Thank you. Dr. Stinson, any questions? Commissioner Hansen?
Actually, I do have a question, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you for coming. Senator Johnson.
Dr. Stinson, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stinson, I'm trying to remember in my own head what were the years? Was it the 60s, the late 60s, that we were seeing record mortgage rate highs?
No. 80s.
Mr. Chairman,
the 70s?
Senator Johnson, I bought a house in 1969, and it was a record mortgage rate high for the time, but the record mortgage rate highs were in the 1980s, the early 1980s. That's when they were double digit and more.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Stinson, could that correlate into what you were saying earlier about what was happening in the 80s? I mean, how did the mortgage rates play into that? It sounded like in 83, were they almost like 13%? And then you said something happened in 1986. Was there a cause and effect that was going on there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, no, I don't think so. If you remember that the prior treatment of capital gains on sale of residences was that if you reinvested, bought your house for $25,000, you sold it for $45,000, so you had a $20,000 capital gain. But then if you bought another house that was $45,000 or more, that gain was rolled forward. And so it's unlike the situation today where you have a blanket exemption until you have, I think, $500,000 of capital gain. And so I don't think that was it. I'm actually quite sure that it was almost entirely equity activity in there.
Thank
people
you.
Rolling their stock market holdings.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr.
Dr.
Chair.
Dr. Stinson, I believe, Senator Skoy, your division is meeting Tuesday in this time slot?
Tuesday.
Full committee will meet again on Wednesday. Agenda to be announced. This committee's adjourned.